hell is this?
Hello?
Hello, Sour Monster. I want to play a game.
Who the hell are you? What the hell am I doing here?
You'll notice the contraption around your neck is connected to a sawed-off shotgun aimed at your head from across the room.
This is all Noah's fault.
I wouldn't bother squirming if I were you. Resistance is futile. There is, however, a switch on the side of your neck collar. Flip the switch and your brains will be scrambled eggs all over the room.
Oh, well, that's nice.
To your left is a television with TNA Impact on a loop.
Wait, what?
To regain your freedom and live to see another day, all you have to do is watch a series of Dixie Carter promos over and over again for 60 minutes.
No. No.
It's the easiest game you'll ever play.
No. I can't do it.
Whatever you do, just don't flip that... Seriously?
The Sala Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You fat! You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Welcome to episode 310 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, January 19th, 2014. I am alive and well, in fact, despite what you heard there at the beginning. I am the Sala Monster. This week's Sound Off is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download right now at www.audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. We had a whole bunch of people sign up for trials last week. And send me your feedback. I'm curious what you guys think, what books you picked out. You've got a whole wide array of different audiobooks you can choose from, including a whole bunch of wrestling titles. I mentioned last week Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes, Hulk Hogan, and a whole bunch of others. And you can get it on your iPhone, your Android, Kindle, pretty much whatever device you have. So if you want to help support this show, and for those of you who did last week, I thank you for that. But if you want to support the show and get a free audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/Salamos. You could sign up right now, get your free audiobook. It's a quality service. I think you guys will like it, and probably you'll stick around a little bit longer than the 30 days for your free trial. But give it a shot and help support the show in the process. It's a win-win situation. You have nothing to lose, so get on that. We will get into TNA later on in the show. I thought Genesis sucked. I'm not going to really beat around the bush here. So I'll get into my thoughts on that later on, but unfortunately, some sad news to start out with this week. WWE Hall of Famer Mae Young, who has been in poor health for a while, passed away this past week at the age of 90. Her goal had been to wrestle Stephanie McMahon on her 100th birthday, which would have been the year 2023, but it was not meant to be. You know, when I think of Mae Young, I think of her time with Moolah during the Attitude Era. And in a way, it's kind of a shame. You know, it's kind of like Patterson and Briscoe. Pat Patterson and Gerald Briscoe were two very accomplished wrestlers in their day. Hall of Famers. You know, Briscoe, part of the legendary Briscoe family with his brother Jack. Patterson, also in his day, one of the best of all time. And a lot of people, especially younger fans, will probably only ever know those guys as the Stooges. You know, Patterson would go around acting like a goofball and Briscoe would go over to Vince McMahon, "Oh, Mr. McMahon, can I get you some coffee?" And that's how a lot of people are going to remember those guys. And I think Moolah and Mae Young, to some degree, are probably in a similar situation. They were part of so many goofy comedy skits, and Mae Young would come out and strip, and the stuff with Mark Henry. And she was entertaining as all hell, but I don't think a lot of people have a concept of what a tough woman she was. And it's not as though she had all of this great success and all of these championships in her wrestling career. She had a good career. It wasn't like she was one of the greatest of all time, but you know, she was one tough lady back in the day, and even at her age now. I mean, look at some of the stuff she did back in the late 90s. Bubba Ray Dudley powerbombing her off the stage. Bubba was more nervous about that than she was. She took a guitar shot once to the head. I mean, she was beaten up quite a bit. And I remember that. I remember the storyline with Mark Henry, which I'd rather forget about. The Miss Royal Rumble contest back in 2000 at Madison Square Garden. Thank God I wasn't there in the building for it. Actually, maybe I should have been, because I was watching on pay-per-view and had a front row seat for her. It's not even a strip tease. She basically took her top off at the Rumble. There's still a lot of debate to this day on whether or not that was actually a prosthetic that was made for the stunt. I sure hope so, but either way, I tried to block that out of my mind. And she was inducted into the Hall of Fame with Moolah in 2008, a well-deserved honor. She lived a long life. It's hard to complain when you reach the age of 90. I don't know too many people who get to the age of 90. I don't even know very many wrestlers who get to the age of 90 these days. Let me just get to the PayPal shout-outs really quick here. I don't want to forget these. Tim from Germany, John Haney, Jeffrey Matthews, and Mitchell Montgomery all contributed via PayPal to the Sound Off this week. Thank you, gentlemen, all of you. I appreciate it very much. You can always make a PayPal donation directly to the show. Still the best way to show your support on thesolemonster.com. That's thesolemonster.com. Some people said they went to solemonster.com. I still think it's run by some college professor for like the last 13 years or whatever. Thesolemonster.com. There's a little PayPal donate box you can give there. Also, I want to talk about my latest Layfield Report column, which went up a few days ago during the week. Decided to go ahead and make the case for a Brock Lesnar-Daniel Bryan match at WrestleMania 30. As unlikely as that may sound, it may not be as unlikely as you think. The seeds are already planted if they wanted to go in that direction. And it's weird because Bryan, and we'll talk about Bryan in a second here, he had a big week. Bryan is in the unique position of being able to wrestle almost anybody on the roster and have it make sense. There are so many match possibilities open for Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania 30. It's unbelievable. You can conceivably put him in there with Brock, which I make the case for in the column on layfieldreport.com. You could put him in there with John Cena and have the rematch between the two of them. Cena has already been on TV talking about how, you know, if I get the title back, you get the first crack at it, you get a rematch. You could put Bryan in there with Triple H. You know, I know that feud is kind of simmered down a little bit. They're going more in the direction of Punk and Triple H, but you could still do Bryan versus Triple H and have him finally get his revenge on the Authority. There's been rumors of maybe Bryan and The Undertaker, that The Undertaker had wanted to work with Bryan. That doesn't mean he will. You know, The Undertaker has a lot of cachet backstage, but just because he says something doesn't mean it's going to happen. You know, Undertaker went to Vince McMahon a few years ago when he and Shawn had their second match at WrestleMania, and they both wanted Jim Ross to call that match. Guess what? That didn't happen. But supposedly he has said he wants to work with Bryan, and I think that'd also be an awesome match. But you could put Bryan in there with Sheamus. That was another idea I pitched. If Sheamus is able to come back from shoulder surgery in time for WrestleMania, I would bring him back as a heel. And the person who put him out of action in that Money in the Bank match was Daniel Bryan. Now, it would be a step down for Bryan. I don't necessarily want to see that match at WrestleMania. But I'm just saying, you could conceivably put the two of them in the ring together as well. Bryan and Shawn Michaels, it's not going to happen. I know some people are holding out hope. Shawn's not coming back. It'd be an awesome match, but it's not going to happen. But I like that you can put him in almost any situation and it would make sense, or it would be a fantastic match. But the match with Brock, I really, really like. It's a total mismatch on paper if you look at it. Brock is this gigantic beast. Bryan is not. Bryan has a funny personality when he wants to. There ain't nothing funny about Brock Lesnar. And if you laugh at him, he'll pound you into the ground. But they're both really great wrestlers. You know, some people don't give Brock enough credit. They look at him as this part-time guy. Oh, he comes in, he wrestles twice a year, he makes $1 million. It's not fair. He's taking up a spot from somebody else. Same people who probably complained about The Rock being in the WrestleMania main event. I said it in the column. I wouldn't want those people running my wrestling school, let alone my wrestling company. These people don't understand the concept of good business. But Brock, back in the day, you know, NCAA wrestler, went to WWE, had some awesome matches. He's a really good wrestler. And Bryan, we already know what he can do in the ring. So I think you put those two together, and Brock, for a guy as big as he is very agile. He will bump around for you. Sometimes, I mean, a lot of times he'll oversell it. Like when Big Show hurled him across the ring a few weeks ago, and there was a little bit, they kind of mistimed the spot, and Brock essentially hurled his own body halfway across the ring. You don't see too many guys of his size flying around the ring like that. That's part of what makes Brock so awesome and makes his matches so much fun. He can sell for you. He's not some big lug that's just going to stand there and not sell and take a beating and just turn around and beat other people up and not give something back. So as a match, I think it would be great. As a story, it makes sense. And a good chunk of the column is devoted to why it makes sense storyline-wise. Brock's already been on TV with Paul Heyman talking about, I want the next shot at the title. And Bryan, I don't know if Bryan's going to be in the Rumble or not. He's got the concussion now. Even without the concussion, I'm not sure that's the direction that they want to go in. But I will say this. I'll let you guys read the column if you want to, but I will say this. They started a story with Daniel Bryan over the summer that people got into. And I know the SummerSlam buy rate was not good. So maybe they didn't get into it as much as I did and some other people did. But from week to week, you hear the reaction for Bryan. You know, he's selling merchandise. He's one of their top guys. The story they told was the Authority beat him down and beat him down at every turn. And every time he was this close from getting one over on them and winning the title, they would snatch it away from him. And that left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths because they like Daniel Bryan. Or maybe they just like a story where in the end the good guy wins. I know the good guy doesn't always win in real life, but that's the story they were telling. And then they got away from that story a little bit. They put Bryan with the Wyatts. They had Big Show get a title shot. Then they went back to Cena and Orton. And Bryan was almost this forgotten guy in all this. They owe it to the fans to finish the story. Don't just leave it hanging. People are still into this guy, as evidenced by last Monday. In spite of him being knocked down a few pegs, they still buy him as a top guy. They love this guy. They want to see him succeed. They want to see him at some point win the championship back for real this time and have a real run of at least a couple of months instead of a day. So I think they owe it to the fans to finish the story that they started over the summer that felt like it would never end and really wasn't all that good because they gave you screw job after screw job after screw job, and you can only avoid giving the people what they want for so long before they just say, you know what, the hell with this. And it's not too late to finish the story. That's all I'm saying. And Brock is just the perfect antagonist for it. You know, David versus Goliath, big guy versus little guy. Bryan may be a small guy compared to Brock, but I don't think it's a case where they wouldn't buy him in the ring against Brock. I'm sure some people do feel that way. I felt that way about CM Punk when they were hyping up a CM Punk-Brock Lesnar match. I didn't see it. I didn't see Punk in there with Brock. It didn't compute. And then they went out there and they had the match of the year. I was wrong. I know I'm not wrong about this, though. This match makes sense. So if you want to read more about that, go to layfieldreport.com. The column is up there. Leave some feedback. Let me know what you think. Is that a match that you would like to see? Can you buy Brock Lesnar one-on-one with Daniel Bryan? And can you buy it as a WrestleMania main event for the championship? Raw last Monday night was in Providence, Rhode Island. One of the big stories coming out of the show. The Ultimate Warrior, officially named the first inductee into the WWE Hall of Fame class of 2014. He'll be inducted the night before WrestleMania in New Orleans. Still some of the best theme music in wrestling history. It's the Ultimate Warrior's music. And say what you want about the guy, but one of the most colorful characters in the history of the business. As much as I like realism with my wrestling, I do wish we had more batshit insane characters like him on TV. Everything now just is so sanitized compared to some of those characters back in the day. Plus, you know, that damn wellness policy. You know for a fact that cocaine and roids were responsible for at least 85% of those memorable promos we all saw throughout the 80s. We can never have those days back again. He's part of two of the most memorable matches in WrestleMania history. WrestleMania 6 against Hulk Hogan, which I cannot impress upon you how epic a match that was to a young fan back then. It was huge. And WrestleMania 7 against the Macho King Randy Savage, his greatest opponent. CM Punk tweeted on Monday night, after they made the announcement about the Warriors induction, long overdue, Randy Savage next, please. Well, it's up to Vince. I don't think there is a single person in that company, aside from Vince McMahon, who does not want Randy Savage in the Hall of Fame. All the top stars want him in. We interviewed John Cena in Miami over WrestleMania 28 weekend. You can go back in the archives and listen to Sound Off 212. And it was either Brian or Noah. I think it was Noah, actually, who asked him why Randy Savage isn't in the Hall of Fame. And Cena had no idea. He said he belongs in there, and if he had a vote, then he would be in. So I guess even Super Cena doesn't get a vote for the Hall of Fame because it's 2 years later now, and nothing has changed. I have to talk about this. Warrior had a very eventful, yet short-lived career as a public speaker. I'm sure some of you remember this. My personal experience with him goes back to my college days. when I went to college at Hofstra, which is a school here in New York, out on Long Island, and they brought the Warrior to Hofstra University for a speaking engagement. And I found out about this. I must have seen flyers on campus, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, Ultimate Warrior is coming to speak to our school. I have to go. I have to be there. So I went, and it was one of the most surreal experiences I've ever had. You know, I took so many courses, as I'm sure many of you did, over your college career, and what I actually took away from many of those classes, I could probably, you know, count on one hand. The most memorable experience in terms of things that I learned, like in a lecture hall, wasn't from any of those classes. It was sitting there listening to this maniac up there rambling on about all these things that just didn't make any sense at all, getting very angry and agitated for no apparent reason. He went on and on about these great books of the Western world. I'm not sure if anybody's heard him talk about this before, and I don't even know if he does talk about this anymore. But I guess there was a period of time where Warrior went on this reading kick with the great books of the Western world. And he said it transformed his view of life. And I remember him talking about this, and then he kind of got a sense that people probably didn't know what he was talking about, probably got a lot of blank stares from the college kids. And he stopped, and he got very angry, and he said, how many of you have read the great books of the Western world? How many of you even know what the great books of the Western world are? And you could hear crickets in this auditorium. Nobody, not one person spoke up, not one person raised their hand. He got so angry. He couldn't believe it. He was like, what are these people teaching you here? And he just went on and on and on. And then came the Q&A portion, where they were going to allow students to come out on each, you know, there was an aisle on the left side, an aisle on the right side, and they put a microphone stand. So you would just, you know, form a line, walk up to the microphone, and ask Warrior your question. And there was one Asian student who went up to the microphone, and I don't remember exactly how he worded the question. I don't remember it coming off as being overly, you know, disrespectful or anything like that, but he basically asked the Warrior a question about him taking steroids. And in response to this very non-threatening question from this student, the Warrior threatened this man, and he threatened to put him through a table. I think it was something like, you know, I'll show you if I'm on steroids right now. Why don't you come down here and I'll put you through this table? And everyone cheered. I felt like I was at a wrestling event. The only thing missing was the popcorn. But when I met him, when the event was over, we got to go up and get pictures and autographs. And I'm not big on autographs, so I said, I want to go get my picture taken with this man. Nicest guy. He was as nice as could be. There's a photo of me and him actually up on our Facebook page. If you go into the photo album called The Secret Files, I got some personal pictures in there. And one of them is the photo of me and the Warrior from 10 years ago. And he really does. Somebody made a comment under the photo, but it's really true. It looked like he was selling me a used car. But he had the biggest smile on his face. I think I still look like a deer in headlights because I couldn't believe what I had just seen. So that was my experience with him. And then there was the incident the following year at UConn. They invited the Warrior to speak at the University of Connecticut. The Young Republicans invited him to come do a lecture. And all hell broke loose. And they ended up having to apologize when it was over for inviting the Warrior in the first place. Because he went off on a student. And if you want to, the video of it is up on YouTube. Somebody had their phone and they filmed almost the entire lecture. I think there's highlights of it up on YouTube. If you type in, you know, Warrior at UConn. And there was a student, I think a female student maybe, who asked him a question, I guess, about homosexuality or something. And there have been rumors for a number of years about stuff that Warrior may have been or that Warrior may have done very, very early on in his wrestling career or even just before he got into wrestling. I know Missy Hyatt has talked about this over the years. She's not the only one. Who knows if it's true or not? And whether or not that has had an effect on his feelings when it comes to this. But he, you know, of course, he went off on homosexuality, and he made the infamous comment, queering doesn't make the world work. I think that's the comment that got him into a lot of hot water. That's what he said. Again, it's on video if you want to go back and watch it. You know, if you really want some genuine entertainment at the Hall of Fame, I say get Darren Young to induct him into the Hall. See, now that would be fun. Like car wreck fun. I just hope Warrior thanks Triple H in his speech for letting him squash him and no-sell his finish at WrestleMania 12. That's the only hope I have for his speech. I have no idea what this man is going to talk about. I can only imagine. But as long as he gets that little dig in there on Triple H, that would bring a smile to my face. Them reaching a deal to bring him in for the Hall of Fame is really not all that surprising, even though there's been a lot of acrimony between the two sides over the years. There's been so many lawsuits back and forth, mostly from Warrior suing Vince. I mean, they've been in litigation probably more than they've been in business together over the years. And one of the things, supposedly, that Warrior wanted was an apology for the hit job they did on him with their Self-Destruction of the Ultimate Warrior DVD. Now, I don't know that he's going to get an apology, but they are doing another DVD on his career. It's called The Ultimate Collection. It's coming out just before WrestleMania on April 1st. I think that may have been part of the deal, I would imagine. You know, it probably was getting out a new DVD that sort of undid the damage of the first one, which he was very upset about. And rightfully so, for years, when they would try to get Warrior into the Hall of Fame, because they've courted him for so long. And they've had conversations in the past, and it just didn't work out. But every time they would come to him and say, listen, we want to get you in the Hall of Fame, he would ask them, if everything you said about me in that DVD is true, why would you want me in your Hall of Fame? That's a great question. I mean, we know why, because money talks, but that's a great question. And I have to bring this up, because one of the stories they tell on that DVD, and it's a story that's been peddled for years, and it's kind of taken on a life of its own, is that Warrior was fired right after the main event ended at SummerSlam 91, because he held up Vince McMahon that night for more money, right before the match. So Vince agreed to all of his demands in a panic just to get him to wrestle the match, and then he fired him when he came back through the curtain. Okay, that was the story. Warrior wanted to make the same money that Hulk Hogan was making. He wanted all the same days off that Hogan got, which was ridiculous. Warrior was never the draw that Hogan was. He didn't deserve to be making the same money that Hogan was. He was out of his mind if he thought so. But, the story that he held up Vince for more money the night of the show, and Vince had no choice but to, you know, agree to his demands just to save the show, complete bullshit. I came across a copy of a letter on WWF stationery that was mailed to the Warrior back when he was still Jim Hellwig. It looks like it was entered into evidence as one of the many lawsuits between Warrior and WWE. It has a case number on it. It says it was filed on May 15th, 2009. So this has probably been floating around the internet for a while, but I only first saw it just recently. And it's pretty damning stuff. It's Vince McMahon's response to a handwritten note that Warrior sent him about how he feels he hasn't been adequately compensated. Again, he wants to be paid commensurate with what Hogan was making, and all that is true. And this letter was Vince McMahon's response, basically agreeing to all of the demands that the Warrior had made. I have the letter open right here. It's fascinating to read this thing. It says, you will be paid the amount of $550,000 for your participation in WrestleMania 7. With the exception of special events only, you will receive 4 days off every other time off period. Your pay rate on house shows will go up 4-5% of the net. Effective immediately, your royalty rate on all forms of merchandise will be increased. The specific amount will be determined in writing within 1 week. Your compensation for the Warrior 900... I didn't even know Warrior had a 900 hotline. I know Hogan did. But it says your compensation for your 900 number will be identical to that of the Hulk 900 hotline. So all of these things in this letter are laid out very specifically by Vince McMahon. And the date on the letter, July 13, 1991, a full 6 weeks before SummerSlam. I'll post a copy of this letter on our Facebook page if anybody wants to see it, facebook.com/thesolemonster. It's right there in writing. He agreed to all of the guy's demands. He didn't fight him on anything. And he even said he has the deepest admiration and appreciation for him as a performer, a man, and my friend. So he gave him what he wanted, waited 6 weeks, and then fired him. So if at any point in the last 6 years I answered a mailbag question about this, and I'm pretty sure I did, if I peddled that bogus story about him holding Vince up, I apologize. I was wrong. It's a weird thing, because it's not like Vince couldn't suspend the Warrior after he made those initial demands and changed the SummerSlam main event. He did the exact same thing the next year. He changed the tag team main event of Survivor Series weeks in advance, ironically enough, after firing the Warrior. That was when they suspected him of using growth hormone, that he was importing it from overseas, him and the Bulldog. So they both got fired. That was back when Vince was actually taking steroid testing very, very seriously, because all the heat was on him from the government at the time. It was supposed to be Warrior and Randy Savage against Ric Flair and Razor Ramon. But they replaced Warrior with Mr. Perfect. Could have done the same thing here. Just replace Warrior with Sid Justice or something. Sid was the special referee for that tag team match anyway. That was his first appearance, I think, in WWE. Just put him in there with Hogan. Vince should apologize to him publicly for saying that. I actually agree with the Warrior. That thing was a complete hit job. And as nutsy cuckoo as the Warrior may really be, and there may have been a lot of truths in that DVD really was an assassination piece. That story was completely bogus, and Vince should apologize. Whether he will or not, I'm guessing not. But he should. He should do the right thing. The other big story from Raw last Monday was the return of Daniel Bryan. Daniel Wyatt is dead. Long live Daniel Bryan. And to all the people who said, oh, it's a heel turn. They turned him heel. I can't believe they did that. Like I said from day one, he never turned heel. I thought it was all a ruse and that they were going to expose it at the Royal Rumble. So I was wrong about that. It wasn't a ruse. Or maybe it was. Maybe I take that back. Maybe it was a ruse. Maybe the whole idea was that Kane is in cahoots with Bryan. He's like a mole in the authority. Remember, on Raw Monday night, when Kane was backstage with Brad Maddox, and they made that tag team cage match, Maddox made the match, and then Kane said, yeah, well, I'm going to put a chain around the door so nobody can get in and out. Now, do I actually think they have enough foresight in terms of their storylines to actually think of something like that, where Kane is a mole, you know, the whole time? I don't think so. I doubt very seriously that that's the direction that they're going in. It's fun to think about. I mean, it was the Wyatts who left Kane laying at SummerSlam, and when he came back, he went corporate and surrendered himself to the authority. But maybe it was a case where Bryan finally got Bray all to himself inside the cage, and it was premeditated. We'll find out more on TV maybe this Monday. But they did the deal where the Wyatts, it was Bray and Bryan at the beginning of the show, they went up against the Usos. And how about those Usos? Opening and closing the show with wins. You know, for a team they were doing nothing with the early part of last year, they've really stepped up and become a force in the tag team division, not just background players. I really think it goes back to that Money in the Bank pre-show match with The Shield last summer. It was one of my favorite matches all year. That was such a great match. I think it opened a lot of eyes, and they've been on something of a roll ever since. They still haven't won the tag team titles, but I think they will in due time. They've done a lot better than I ever thought they would. And the one thing is, I fear that with the end of the show, what happened with Bryan, that maybe this win was overlooked. Their win was almost just background noise more than anything else. But let's not forget about their awesome night, too. Got to give them credit here. And I love that split-screen promo they did with them before the main event. Very old-school feel to it. But back to Bryan. The cage match ends. Usos win. Bray went to go give him Sister Abigail. Bryan broke away, and then at that point, a crowd which had been dead pretty much, not the whole night necessarily, but for that match, they were awfully quiet to the point where I could hear the air conditioning running in the background in the arena. This place just came unglued like I've never seen a crowd come unglued before. It was just beautiful. It was a beautiful sight. It was one of the best memorable endings of a Raw episode in history. I don't know where it ranks. You know, I did a listing a while back of the top 30 Raw moments, and I think I did that right around the time they did Raw 1000. And if I can go back and redo that list, this moment would be on that list. Where it would rank from 1 to 30, I don't know, but it would definitely be on that list. This was awesome. It was awesome. And I don't have a big screen HD TV, but if I did, I can only imagine what that camera shot would have looked like when they had Bryan doing the yes chant right before the flying knee. And you could just see the entire arena. They had this wide shot of the crowd, and everybody was just doing it in unison, faster and faster and faster. It reminded me of the Michigan State video that popped up a couple of weeks ago, where all the fans at the Michigan State game were doing the yes chants. And from what I read an item in the F4W newsletter this week that said the reason that Bryan turned back so quickly, because it was very, very rushed. You know, I thought for sure they would at least let it go until the Rumble. I heard stories that maybe they were going to let it go until WrestleMania. I think that would have been way too long. I never thought that 2 weeks later they would kill the storyline. So something happened that made them rush it. And the theory put forth in the newsletter makes about as much sense as anything else I've read, that being, when the footage from the Michigan State game came out, and it was all over SportsCenter, and it was all over the blogs, and Deadspin, and everywhere else, it made them rethink their position on this storyline and say, oh shit, we got to get this guy back to where he was before. Because this guy's getting mainstream publicity, and meanwhile, simultaneously on television in this storyline, he's under the spell of a couple of hillbillies, a group of hillbillies from down in Florida, or wherever the Wyatts are from. So, it was for the better that they killed it. It made no sense the way this was all rushed. Absolutely, it made no sense. But it was for the better. Now, the one negative about this is that Brian, somewhere in all of this, suffered a concussion. And I went back and watched that cage match. If it was in the cage match that had happened, I'm guessing it happened on the back suplex spot. I think it was Brian with both Usos. And they gave him a back suplex off the top rope. That would be the only place in that match where I could conceivably see him suffering a concussion. Otherwise, I have no idea when it happened. He didn't forget anything in terms of the spots he was supposed to do at the end. He didn't look like he was concussed, that's for sure. Climbed up to the top of the cage when the show was over. Sat there. Did more yes chants. Apparently, he got confused after a while. He started looking around. Didn't quite know what to do. There was a worker down on the ground looking up at him saying, you know, go ahead, keep doing the yes chants. And Brian was looking at him all confused. So it was a pretty serious concussion, it sounds like, that he suffered. He has virtually no memory, from what I've read, of the match. Which, if that's true, I mean, that really sucks, because you have to think that had to be one of the highlights of this guy's career. One of those moments that, you know, he'll look back on probably years from now thinking, wow, can't believe that reaction was for me. And if he really doesn't have any memory of it at all, that's kind of a cruel twist of irony there, but you know, let's see what happens. They've made no statements about it on WWE.com. They put no announcement out announcing that Brian has a concussion. All the key websites like PW Insider, ProWrestling.net, The Observer, they all obtained statements directly from WWE spokespeople admitting that, yes, he did suffer a concussion. They just have not made that announcement public to the masses on their own website. So there's no question that he suffered a concussion. The only question now is the severity of it. How bad is it? I noticed they had a house show last night. I forgot where. Brian did not appear on the house show as advertised, so they're keeping him out of action. How does that affect the Royal Rumble? It's too early to tell. It would really be a shame if he couldn't be a part of that pay-per-view. You know, the pay-per-view is only a week away. And as we've seen before with guys like Dolph Ziggler and Fandango and others, when you suffer a concussion, let alone a serious concussion, they're going to keep you out for at least a few weeks until you're no longer exhibiting symptoms. So my guess would be that he'll be tested again on Monday. I don't know if they'll fly him to the show, but I mean, I'm sure they could put him on Raw even if he doesn't do anything physical. So if he's flown in for Raw Monday night, then they'll do some impact testing on him backstage, and at that point they'll determine if he's okay to compete. I think they would keep him out anyway until the pay-per-view, but let's hope everything works out well. When it comes to concussions, that's just stuff you don't want to fuck around with. Brian has had a ton of concussions, which is not surprising, given the style he wrestled on the indies. So he's had a ton of concussions, probably a lot of undiagnosed concussions over his career. Dolph Ziggler is still out from his concussion, his second in less than a year. I don't think Brian will have the same worries that a guy like Ziggler or Fandango might have when they get hurt and come back, and then WWE decides to do nothing with them. It's just the timing of everything, Royal Rumble, WrestleMania season. This is not an injury that Brian wants to linger for too long, so hopefully he'll be okay. Damian Sandow had a real good showing on Raw last week. He had a match with John Cena. Not as good as their Money in the Bank cash-in match last year, but they gave Sandow a ton of offense on the guy who's wrestling for the world title on pay-per-view. You know, lots of false finishes. Cena was selling it with his facial expressions like, I don't know how to beat this guy, which is comical. Cena busted out a tornado DDT at one point during the match, which looked all wacky. So the match was good. You know, the finish was good. Cena reversed a crossface into an attitude adjustment. Sandow loses, as he should have, but he looked good in defeat. The announcers built him up strong on commentary. I have zero faith that they're going to go anywhere with it. How many times have we seen this before? How many times have we seen this with Sandow, with Ziggler, with Kofi a few years ago? You start building them, and then you just yank the rug right out from underneath them. It's hard for people to care after a while. I think I may be at that point with Sandow. Kofi Kingston and Randy Orton on the show had an ungodly boring match. It was more or less one never-ending chin lock by Orton. I thought it would never end. 17 minutes this thing went. Felt like 70. Awfully quiet, also, in the building for the so-called face of WWE. Kofi got the big shock win with his SOS move. Clean in the middle. 1-2-3. I just got done talking about how they should do more shock finishes in the mailbag the week before. I thought it was cool, but if they don't follow up on it, it's just a fluke, and it means nothing. You know, the 1-2-3 kid, when he got that fluke win over Razor Ramon back in 93, he kept winning matches. He beat DiBiase after that. He beat several other people. Here, Kofi had his ass handed to him for 17 minutes, got the pin out of nowhere, and to prove that they have no intentions of pushing him as anything special, on commentary, all Michael Cole could talk about was how embarrassed and humiliated Randy Orton was for losing to Kofi Kingston. And I think Lance Storm said it best on Twitter. He was watching Raw, and he heard that, and he said, you know, he got pinned by Kofi, not my mom. Let's give Kofi some credit. And that's a good point. You know, my logic after watching this is that Kofi Kingston beat Randy Orton, right? Alexander Rusev, if you remember, on NXT a couple of weeks ago, beat Kofi Kingston. Therefore, Alexander Rusev should be the WWE champion facing John Cena at the Royal Rumble. I'm just saying. I'm just putting it out there. Speaking of NXT, we saw the debut of Emma on Raw Monday night, kind of. They had a brief camera shot of her standing in the crowd holding up a sign that said Emma Taining, and nobody around her seemed to have any idea who she was. She's a hot chick standing there. All these dudes around her. It's almost like she doesn't even exist. She did the same thing on SmackDown Friday night. I would hope this is a sign that she's debuting soon. Either that or, you know, I guess it's possible that they're only putting her on TV to get some early hype for the NXT special on the network next month. I certainly hope it's more than just that. They're bringing her up. By the way, I don't get to watch SmackDown every single week, but I wanted to see the New Age Outlaws against Cody and Goldust. So I watched the show. When I heard that Miz was going to be on commentary for the entire time, I almost turned it off. Not going to lie. I just couldn't stomach the thought of it. But I stuck with it, and I'm glad I did, because JBL... And JBL has his hit-or-miss nights. He can be very overbearing on Raw sometimes. But then he has his nights where he's just on point and he's freaking awesome. And this was one of them. JBL absolutely roasted The Miz on the headset on Friday night. It was beautiful. At one point, JBL asked him, you know, what happened? You were once relevant once upon a time. What the hell happened? At another point, Miz was talking about how, you know, I headlined WrestleMania once, and he asked JBL if he ever did the same thing, which he kind of did, also against John Cena. I know it wasn't the last match on the show, but you could argue that, in fact, JBL did headline a WrestleMania. But JBL had the line of the year when he called Miz a one-hit wonder and said he was WWE's version of Right Said Fred. I fucking died. Oh, that was so awesome. So that was my entertainment from SmackDown on Friday night. My entertainment quota was filled on this show. I may have to watch more often. Only other things on Raw to really mention here. I thought it was weird that Big Show beat up an elderly man. You know, he KO'd poor Zeb Coulter for no good reason at all. And then he did the Nazi salute. And he's a babyface. Nazi Big Show is not a good gimmick idea. And we all saw the New Age Outlaws turn, if you could call it that, on CM Punk. In their match against the Shield, they hopped down off the apron when Punk went for the tag, clearly building to a Triple H CM Punk match at WrestleMania, which has been rumored for a while. The Outlaws got a win over Cody and Goldust on Friday night, non-title, and it looks like they're going to be sticking around for a while as characters on TV. They may even get a tag team title match at the Royal Rumble. And I don't know that I would break Cody and Goldust up just yet, but if they want to do a match between the two of them at WrestleMania, I hope they go with the idea that I proposed on the Sound Off a few months ago. I laid out the whole storyline from start to finish between Cody and Goldust, how I would do it. And I would have no problem with them if they are going to break up, and I almost hope they don't, but if they do, I'd have no problem with them dropping the belts to the Outlaws. I think they could have one last short run with the belts, and then they can drop them at WrestleMania or something, you know, to a team like the Usos or some sort of fatal four-way tag team match at WrestleMania, get the Outlaws in there with the Usos and, you know, the Shield and, you know, throw one other team in there. I'd have no problem with that. In fact, as a novelty, when Cody and Goldust are ready to lose, I would put the belts on the Outlaws. Why not? Run through the NXT review for last week's show. Triple H came out at the beginning to announce the live special on February 27th on the WWE Network. From what I'm reading, it sounds like it may be a two-hour special from 9 to 11 p.m., which if it is, means it's going head-to-head with TNA Impact. So I don't think there's a way for us to measure how many people are watching NXT on the network, so we can't compare ratings. It would be kind of fun, though, I think, to compare how NXT does to how Impact does. Adrian Neville and Tyler Breeze opened the show. Neville beat Breeze with his red arrow corkscrew off the top rope. This was the longest and the most competitive match we've seen Tyler Breeze in to date. And it was really good. These two work very well together. And I like that we're getting to see a more aggressive side to the Tyler Breeze character, so he's not just a comedy figure. You know, the guy's got moves. He was really good in there. I really enjoyed this match. And then we had CJ Parker. Unfortunately, CJ Parker is back. He defeated Jason Jordan. God, I hate this man. I really, really cannot stand CJ Parker. The only good thing about him is his finish. I do dig the finish. He calls it the third eye. It's really just a palm thrust to the face. It's like something you'd see in a Steven Seagal movie back in the day, where he would just, you know, one palm thrust was enough to kill somebody. But it looks brutal. So I do like that. That's about the only good thing I could say about this guy's character. They announce him as being from the Moonchild Convent. I wish we could send him to the moon and then fly back and leave him there. So yeah, Parker won with the third eye. I felt I needed to explain that move to all the non-NXT watchers out there, because if I were listening to this show and I heard that a guy was using the third eye as a finish, I'd think I was watching a Jenna Jameson movie, not a wrestling match. Jason Jordan, I've only seen him use as an enhancement guy in the past. This was his first appearance in a while, but they seem to like the guy's background since they always mentioned the fact that he was a three-sport athlete in high school. This is from his bio on WWE.com. I'll just read a little bit of it to you here. In high school, Jordan was a three-sport super jock playing football, wrestling, and baseball. He was drafted for professional baseball but passed up the offer to go to college and wrestle. Graduate of Indiana University, he wrestled in the elite Big Ten Conference, where he became a three-time national qualifier for NCAA at the Division I level. After earning a bachelor's degree in biology, Jordan made the tough decision to forego his path to dental school to pursue the dream of being a wrestler. Well, that's too bad. The last wrestler that went to dental school ended up having a pretty good career for himself. I think old Jason Jordan may have made the wrong decision there. Bo Dallas, the NXT champion, beat Mojo Rawley, their big baby face of the future. Mojo is still very, very green. His offense consists mostly of running into people and yelling at them to get hyped. Bo didn't quite know what to make of this man. In the end, Dallas dodged a splash in the corner, rolled up Rawley with a handful of trunks. Not much to it, but we did get a shot of the champ in the aisleway when the match was over, mouthing, "Don't stop believing." My week of NXT watching is never complete until I hear or see Bo Dallas say those words to the crowd, and he did. I love Bo Dallas. People can't understand why I like this guy so much, because he is tremendous at playing his character. That's why. The problem with a guy like CJ Parker is he's too good at playing his character, and his character sucks. That's the difference. Kofi Kingston and Alexander Rusev was our main event of the evening, a rematch, as Rusev beat Kingston in their first battle. Rusev got a big win over a main roster guy the first time out, pretty much decisively, I might add. So I pretty much figured Kofi was getting his win back here, which is exactly what happened. This match, let me say this first. These fans in the NXT arena did not care at all about this match. They started random chants of Goldberg, chants of Feed Me More. I thought Ryback was doing a run-in, but no Ryback in sight. They did a wave at one point. Then they started chants of this side and that side. So now they were chanting at each other. Yeah, it's definitely a smark crowd at Full Sail University. They cheer a lot of the heels. They boo some of the baby faces. They go into business for themselves. And a lot of times it makes for a fun atmosphere. But I did feel bad for these two guys. These guys didn't deserve that. The match was fine. A little bit dull, I guess, but there was nothing wrong with it. Kingston caught Rusev with Trouble in Paradise and got the pin, so Kofi is avenged. And that was your episode of NXT this past week. A pretty standard episode, some good wrestling. If there was one thing I would pick out that you should go back and watch that's probably worth your time, I'd say the opener between Neville and Breeze. I give Tyler Breeze a lot of love on this show. I just happen to like the character. And he's a good wrestler, too, which is not surprising, given who trained him. He was trained by Lance Storm. But I like the character a lot. Now it looks like we're finally seeing other layers of the character, a more aggressive side. And when I talked about NXT about a week or two ago on this podcast, and I said, these are the names that you should watch out for main roster call-ups in 2014. I didn't put Breeze on that list, but I put Breeze on my second list, my backup list of guys to watch who... And who knows, maybe he does get called up, but watch them more to see how their characters develop this year. And lo and behold, we're starting already to see other aspects of his character, which is good. He can only do the chicken shit heel who takes selfies and barely wrestles for so long. At some point, he's got to wrestle longer matches. There's got to be other elements to his character. You know, don't make the same mistake you made with a guy like Brodus Clay, where he's just the big dancing goofball who comes out, and there's no mean streak, there's no nothing. There's no depth to the character. I like what I saw here, and the match itself was good. So if I had to say go back and watch one thing, that's what you should go watch. Check this out, guys. For you, the listeners of The Sound Off, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can check out their service. And it's a quality service. I wouldn't be mentioning it on my show if it wasn't. They have a bunch of wrestling books to choose from in audio form, including Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes' book, Hulk Hogan's book is available with narration from the Hulkster himself. There's even one that chronicles the rise of the late Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, which sounds really interesting. You can choose any one of those free by trying audible.com. If you commute to work, or if you like listening to things other than music at the gym, I know a lot of people listen to this podcast that way. It seems to me an audiobook would absolutely make sense. To get one, make sure you go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. It's another way to show your support for The Sound Off, and you get something free in return. Can't beat that. Again, that's audibletrial.com/solomonster. Time for the TNA report. They held their live Genesis special on Spike TV this past Thursday night. I thought it sucked. First live show in something like 2 months. Their shows have been in the can for the last 6 weeks or so. And they make the brilliant decision to fill the show with talking, talking, and more talking. And they bump two of the scheduled matches to next week's show. Kurt Angle and Bobby Roode in a cage and the Storm vs. Gunner match for Gunner's briefcase ended up not happening. Total bait and switch on this show. I mean, you know, at least we didn't have to pay for it. It wasn't a pay-per-view, but still, that's no excuse. I was looking forward to the show. I really was. It was going to be, you know, their first show of 2014, if you think about it. Everything up to this point was taped last year. This was a chance for a fresh start amidst all the turmoil and all the negativity and all the stories that have been out there about what's going on, people leaving TNA, poor attendance, all of these different things. And what they gave us was more of the same shit. No wonder they had 250 people at their house show on Friday night. They can't run to the UK fast enough. They aired a classy tribute to Mae Young at the start of the show, which was nice. It was a nice touch. Opening segment was Rockstar Spud introducing Queen Dixie. All the heels who helped Magnus beat AJ Styles the week before, they were all invited out to the ring. The way Dixie was talking about Styles here makes me think they've reached a deal, and he's coming back. Magnus came out with two championship belts and gave one to Dixie. So, hey, at least they went with my idea from last week's show about giving the belt to Dixie. She deserves it. Nobody gets more TV time or more heat put on her than Dixie Carter, so they may as well give her the belt. Sting then appeared up in the stands with a baseball bat, old school, cut a promo on the Dixieland faction, said they came to fight, and they turned out to be all the baby faces that got taken out the week before. Joe Park, Eric Young, Samoa Joe, Gunner, James Storm, ODB, broke down into a wild brawl, led to a 12-man tag team match. The brawl and the match were the best things on the entire show. This got the show off to something of a hot start. Babyfaces beat the Bromance, Bad Influence, Zima Ion, and Lady Tappa when Joe made Chris Daniels tap out to the Coquina Clutch. So I don't have anything bad to say about this. This was good stuff. Chris Sabin caught Velvet Sky talking to Austin Aries backstage, and he was not happy. They went out to the ring to hash things out. Aries came out to interrupt. He called Sabin the worst boyfriend that ever lived. He challenged him to an X Division title match at Genesis Part 2 this Thursday, with Velvet Sky outside the ring in a cage. She finally got to cut a promo saying that she was fed up with being used and abused and threatened to leave Saban if he didn't win. At least that's how I interpreted it. Samuel Shaw was complaining a few weeks ago that we had not seen Sam Shaw on television. They introduced this character through a series of vignettes with him and Christy Hemme, and then he kind of disappeared. And he's been back now, which is good. It's good to see him back on TV. But this segment was this was interesting. He was confronted by Pat Kenny, okay, the former Simon Diamond who works backstage in TNA as an agent. And Kenny was complimenting him on his work, and he made one small criticism, I think, about the way he treats Christy. And that was all it took to set off Sam Shaw. Sam Shaw beat Pat Kenny with his own shoe. Literally, he beat him with a sneaker. Although at first he took the time to sniff the sneaker, which was gross. And I guess, I don't know, maybe the character now has a foot fetish? I mean, it's one thing, I guess, to have a fetish, but to go around smelling other men's sneakers, I don't know about that. This guy is way out there. But maybe that's the point. Maybe the point is that this guy is unstable. He's completely whacked out of his mind, and therefore he should be feared. And if that was the goal, mission accomplished. We had a brawl between Bully Ray and Ken Anderson, which was good. It was a good brawl. You know, they brought in some weapons, and the climax of the match was that Bully Ray, with a table in the ring, took out the bottle of lighter fluid. And he teased lighting the table ablaze and putting Ken Anderson through it. Anderson ended up getting the bottle of lighter fluid. He doused the table in that stuff. But then, in the end, he ended up getting pinned. So the table never came into play. The table, there was no fire. They teased the crowd. The people were very disappointed when Bully won this match. I think probably more disappointed they didn't get to see what's-his-face go up in a fireball more than anything else. And this feud, I imagine, is going to continue. This is probably not the last we've seen of these guys. But as a brawl, it was good. It was a good brawl. Kurt Angle confronted Dixie Carter in the ring, angry about getting Al Snow to drive him away from the arena last week under the guise of some family emergency, when in fact there was no family emergency. He said after he beats Bobby Roode tonight in the cage, he's going to be in Sting's corner for the main event against EC3. That's when Dixie said she was going to act in Kurt's best interest and postpone the steel cage match until next week and have Atlas Security escort him out of the building right now. Bobby Roode attacked Kurt Angle from behind, laid him out. Security just stood there like a bunch of idiots. And after Angle was laid out, then security dragged his dead carcass away. Just completely idiotic. From postponing the cage match to Angle getting his ass kicked and security just standing there like a bunch of goofballs. This was a dumb segment. Madison Rain beat Gail Kim to win her fifth Knockouts championship. So Gail Kim's reign comes to an end at 88 days. I don't know where her reign ranks in the annals of TNA Knockouts championship history, but safe to say, Gail Kim, best TNA Knockouts champion ever. I enjoy watching Gail Kim wrestle. This match wasn't that long. I didn't time it like I do the Divas matches, because typically I don't have to. TNA always did much better when it came to allowing the women to go out there and wrestle, although the last few weeks, I think the matches have been fairly short, probably about 4 or 5 minutes long, which is what this was. The American Wolves are officially in TNA. Their big debut was a backstage segment with Dixie Carter, which reminds me, does anybody remember the backstage video of Dixie Carter handing Manic T.J. Perkins his TNA contract? She pretended like it was this big monumental thing for his career and for TNA. No more sleeping outside the venue, she said. When was the last time we saw Manic on TNA television? I'm pretty sure it was Bound for Glory, but I could be wrong. I think it was in the Ultimate X match at the pay-per-view. That was in October. He has not been seen since. I don't know why this segment made me think of that. Kenny King's also been missing. But I specifically remember that segment with TJ Perkins. I even joked it looked like the start of a porn video with him and Dixie. Anyway, she welcomed the Wolves, which it sounds like that's what they're going to be called. She said they were here for tryout matches, which confused the hell out of Davey and Eddie, because they already signed their contract and were officially on the TNA roster. which came as news to Dixie Carter. And they handed her a manila envelope with, it was either a contract inside or some kind of note, I forgot, and they walked away. And she started reading it, and I guess somewhere in there it made mention of a new TNA investor. Because the new investor was responsible for signing the Wolves to contracts. So, great. Another authority figure. As if we don't already have enough of those in wrestling. Remember the network? Who's the mysterious person working for the network? That whole storyline they did in TNA. Did we ever get an answer to that? I just remembered that was during the Joker Sting phase where he was walking around with a birdcage. And he said he was the network guy, but then he admitted later on he lied. He really wasn't the network. Now we have the investor. So that was the big debut Dixie teased on Twitter for Davey Richards and Eddie Edwards. By the way, they don't wrestle on this Thursday show either, in case you were expecting them to. So, for weeks, they build up to this main event of Sting against Ethan Carter III. I've spoken at length about what a pussy Magnus has been booked as since he won the title. The EC3 character is that of a guy who can't beat anybody but scrubs. That's his gimmick. The problem is, that makes two guys with the same character. Neither man can win a match on their own without outside help. The only strong heel in the company right now, as best as I can tell, is Bobby Roode. That's it. There's nobody else. They did nothing here to change that. Rockstar Spud was named the special referee for the match, which really wasn't much of one, with Magnus coming out for the distraction, EC3 rolls up Sting for the fluke pin, less than 5 minutes, match is over. This was your Genesis main event. Sorry, Genesis Part 1. Excuse me. So, all the time they devoted to the Sting EC3 story, which has been going on for several weeks now, is just thrown away so they can promote Sting vs. Magnus on next week's show. Sting got on the microphone when the match was over. He told Magnus he wanted a title shot. Magnus brought up correctly that Sting lost a match last year that barred him from ever again getting a shot at the title. And Sting goaded him a little bit. He said, "Are you going to be a man or are you going to be a little boy?" And that got under Magnus's skin. And Magnus said, "You know what? This is the time of year where TNA normally extends Sting's contract. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I will give you a title shot if you agree to put your contract on the line. And if you lose, Sting, I get to tear your contract up when the match is over." And Sting didn't hesitate at all, which made me laugh. He didn't even think twice. He's like, if I lose, I leave TNA. Sign me up. So that's your main event for Impact this upcoming Thursday. Sting getting another title shot, after all, against Magnus with Sting's TNA contract on the line. And if you don't like spoilers, skip ahead, because I'm going to give you a big fat one right now. For those who don't read the results to the shows typically, and you didn't see the results to Genesis Part 2 coming up this Thursday, Magnus does beat Sting, and he does rip up Sting's contract, which means, in storyline at least, Sting is done with TNA. And again, it was a match that saw a shitload of interference. Reads very much to me like the AJ Styles match. We won't know until we see it, just going based on the results of the people who were actually in the building. But that's what it reads like. Carbon copy of what we saw with AJ Styles 2 weeks ago. The only outcome that even remotely makes any sense is that everyone's coming back. AJ, Sting, Jeff Hardy, all of them. If not, these people are out of their frickin' minds. It's the only thing that makes any sense. This new investor, whoever the hell it is, brings back AJ Styles, brings back Sting and Jeff Hardy to save the day and rescue TNA from Queen Dixie. So maybe AJ's reached a deal in the last week or two to come back. I am not convinced that Sting is going to WWE. All the talk about Sting over the last few days since what happened on Impact and what's going to happen on Impact this upcoming week is all centered around, he's done. That's it. Sting's leaving. He's going home. He's going to WWE where he belongs to get that one last big run. And I am not convinced of this at all. But if he does come in, I am of the opinion that instead of wrestling each other, Sting and Undertaker should team up against The Shield. I'm no longer in favor of Sting versus The Undertaker, if he actually does come in. I think Sting teaming with The Undertaker makes a lot more sense. Undertaker comes back soon, goes after the Shield to avenge their attack on him last year that put him out of action. He hasn't been seen or heard from since. But the odds are too much for him, right? 3-on-1 on Raw one night when all of a sudden the lights go out. And when they come back on, there's Sting standing in the middle of the ring with the long black trench coat, fighting off all three guys with the baseball bat. Imagine the reaction to that. Imagine that moment. They should team, not wrestle. But that's all fantasy booking, because I don't think Sting's going anywhere. People seem to think TNA can't afford him, so he's really going to leave this time. Maybe. Maybe he will, but the reports that I read online indicate that TNA is making it priority number one to re-sign Sting. They do not want to lose him. AJ Styles, they let go. But Sting, he's their top priority. And such is the state of TNA right now. There's nothing else to say. This should have been a special show, and there was nothing special about it at all. Just a lot of the same nonsense. And I just look at the state of things right now, and if this was the best effort they could put forward for their first live show of the new year, trying to turn a new leaf, trying to get people excited about the product at a time when most people are just pointing and mocking them and making fun of them, they had a chance to go out there and put on a kick-ass show. And they didn't. This show is a waste of time. Let's go to the mailbag. If you have questions, email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can also send audio questions in MP3 format. Always include your name and where you are from when you write in. Jeremy from Grove City, Ohio. I heard WWE is looking to put matches in the Hall of Fame. Do you think this is plausible or even a good idea? And if so, what matches would you like to see inducted into the Hall of Fame? And what Jeremy is talking about was a story that was broken by Mike Johnson on PW Insider earlier in the week. This was before the Warrior announcement was made, that WWE is planning on inducting the WrestleMania 1 main event into the Hall of Fame this year. And they're trying to get everybody together, all four guys, Mr. T, who they have not done business with since probably 87. He was still making appearances here and there for them up to 87. So with him, with Hogan, with Piper, who's back in their good graces, and with Paul Orndorff. I'm cool with it. You know, for truly landmark matches, I think it's fine. The first WrestleMania main event is fine, especially since all four of those guys are still alive, which is incredible when you think about how many guys from that era are no longer around, and the fact that three of the four men in that match are cancer survivors, which is even more impressive. I think matches like Hogan versus Andre, you know, Shawn and Razor from WrestleMania 10, the Flair Steamboat series, you can induct that whole series of matches from 1989. You know, you still have your main inductees every single year. The Hall of Fame should still primarily be about people, actual human beings going in. And God knows there's a lot of people who should be in there, including one name in particular, who are not. So that should still be the focus. But you do these matches as a special attraction. You know, one match per year as part of the Hall of Fame ceremony. I could see that, and I'd be okay with that. Glenn Warnicki, the WWE Network is a six-month contract when you sign up. That means you pay for those 6 months, and if you unsubscribe, you still will pay for the full 6 months. If one were to subscribe in mid-November, the contract would end in mid-April. That means you get Survivor Series, TLC, Royal Rumble, Elimination Chamber, and WrestleMania. With that said, should WWE move around the pay-per-view schedule now that three of the big four are in a six-month time period, or should they use this to their advantage and make that fact known to people to try to get them to sign up? I say when that time of year rolls around, use it as part of your marketing to get people to sign up. You're not going to move Royal Rumble or WrestleMania. It's just not going to happen. Chamber and TLC are B-shows, and Survivor Series, I got news for you. It's not a big show anymore. There is no such thing as the Big Four. You can move Survivor Series to whatever month you want. TLC too, but the Rumble and Mania have to stay where they are, especially since they have buildings already booked for WrestleMania like 2 or 3 years in advance, so that's just not going to change. Jake from Long Island, New York, do you see Tough Enough coming back now that the network has been announced, and do you think Steve Austin would still want to host it? It's a good point. You know, they are looking to add reality programming to the network beyond just Legends House. So Tough Enough would fit right in. I think there's a good chance that we see Tough Enough come back. And I think Stone Cold, if they wanted him, would be interested if they asked. He really enjoyed doing that show. If you listen to him on interviews, listen to him on his own podcast, anytime he talks about Tough Enough, he can't believe USA didn't renew it. He thinks that was a horrible decision. He almost sounds pissed off that they didn't renew Tough Enough for a second season. It gave him a chance to get back in the ring without actually getting back in the ring, if you know what I mean. He can get back in there and take some bumps and, you know, work with some of the young kids, but he didn't have to put his body through the kind of stress that he would if he actually came back full time. I think he probably enjoyed that aspect of it too. So I think if they asked him and they brought it back, I think he would do it if he can fit it into his schedule. Yeah, I think he would. Nicolito, if Daniel Bryan was around during the Monday Night War, but was in WCW rather than WWE, would his popularity, presuming he would have been just as popular as he is today, have been enough to go up against Stone Cold Steve Austin's popularity in WWE? Well, first of all, he would not have been as popular as he is today because WCW didn't know how to make new stars. Okay, they lucked into Goldberg. That's number one. And Bryan would have been a midget in the land of giants back then. There was no steroid testing. You know, look at guys like Chris Jericho and Eddie Guerrero. They only got so far in WCW. They had to leave. They had to leave to get opportunities elsewhere to get over as bigger stars. Bryan would have fit right in with those guys. Now, if by chance he was as popular as he is now, No. Nobody could hold a candle to Steve Austin. He cannot compare to Austin even now. And I'm not knocking Daniel Bryan. I like Daniel Bryan. He can't even compare to Austin now. Austin didn't just pop crowds. He sold more merchandise than anybody else. He sold tickets. He sold pay-per-views. You can't compare Daniel Bryan to Steve Austin. Daniel Bryan is a big star to wrestling fans. Stone Cold was the biggest star at a time when wrestling was on fire, and he was a big star to the casual fans, not just the wrestling fans. So the people who were on the fringe and thought wrestling was cool thought it was cool because of Stone Cold. I don't see casual fans looking at wrestling, all due respect to Daniel Bryan, and thinking, hey, this is cool. This guy's cool. The wrestling fans, they love him. They have a lot of respect for him. But the casual fans, I don't see anybody on the current roster, even CM Punk. I don't see anybody on the current roster, clearly, who connects with the casual audience or could connect with the casual audience the way that Stone Cold did. So I think to compare the two is comical. This comes from Nissim Levy. I was saddened to hear about the passing of Mae Young. I think the Slammy Awards should be named after great legends like her. They can start with the Mae Young Award for the Female Wrestler or Diva of the Year, and implement this idea on other awards in the future as well. What do you think? Sure. Yeah, why not? I like that idea. I have no problem with that. Dan Reed from London, UK. After the recent passing of Mae Young and the departure of Caitlyn and the ongoing nightmare known as Total Divas, it got me thinking of notable, legitimate female talents who deserve induction into the Hall of Fame. Our one name, I should say, which seems to stand above all else is Bull Nakano. What are your thoughts about her? An athletic big technician with a Jericho level of hold, she wrestled for WWF in the 80s and the 90s, winning their women's title, and is the only woman in history to hold major titles in American, Japanese, and luchador wrestling promotions. I wonder if a lot of your listeners know this of her and how she transcended the perception of women wrestlers as being incapable of having good, if not better, matches than their male counterparts. Bull Nakano was very successful. She competed in All Japan. They had a women's wrestling promotion, CMLL, and the WWF. What I remember of her in the WWF was when she feuded with Alundra Blaze and beat her for the women's title. That was my earliest memory of her up to that point. Then she went to WCW. She feuded with Alundra Blaze again when she was Medusa, and then she retired the very next year. But she came from an era in Japan where women's wrestling was the real deal. You know, some of these women were tougher than the men. Aja Kong was another one. She also briefly came over to WWE in the mid-90s. That's what I found so exciting about Awesome Kong. You know, Karma coming to WWE, was it 2 years ago, I guess, at this point. She was so different than any other diva they had on the roster, then or now. And it's really too bad she never even got to wrestle a single match on TV. Wrestlers like her and Bull Nakano, they don't come around anymore, you know, because everybody looks the same. They're all these, you know, they're all made up and they all got the big implants, and it's just not the same. You don't have those tough women anymore, because I guess in WWE, which is the top promotion, you know, in the world, just in terms of how big they are, they have a certain perception of women's wrestling and how they should look, and that's become the norm, I think, for a lot of wrestling promotions now, and so you don't see women like her. So she definitely stands out, and I think if you brought her into WWE today, or even TNA, in their knockouts division, she'd be the champion right away, and she should be. She should be that monster on the roster that all your babyface women have to try to topple. But like I said, they don't really have women like her anymore. So she was very unique. Chad Braddix. First, I wanted to congratulate you on your Stitcher Award nomination. I've been listening to the show for a long time and can see the work you put into making the show a success. During the ladder match in SummerSlam 95, there was a spot later in the match where Razor Ramon is laying on the outside of the ring. Shawn Michaels climbs the ladder, jumps off, has his hand on the belt to pull it down with him, but the belt did not unbuckle. Do you think that was the intended finish, or was it done to build up more anticipation during the match? No, that was the intended finish. The belt just didn't unbuckle. And if you remember, Shawn threw a fit, which he was prone to do back then, started cursing, he was throwing the other ladder that was in the ring around, he set it up again, he climbed, and he got the belt. So if it was done to build up anticipation, I don't really know what it accomplished. You know, he had just done a spot, I think Ramon had just tried going for a razor's edge. And he did this thing that was so predictable in all of his matches where he would go to do a razor's edge to somebody, but he was so close to the ropes that you just knew he was going to get backdropped over, and that's what happened. So that's when Shawn climbed, tried to get the belt, and fell, and he was pulling. I mean, if that was planned, which it wasn't, but think about it. If it was planned, that was an awfully dangerous spot because he was hanging from the belt. He was putting all of his weight, trying to pull it down. It would have been very easy for that thing to come undone. It just didn't. And they had a crowd shot. The people were, like, looking up, like, what just happened? And that's when Shawn threw his fit, and Ramon had to stay down on the outside even longer. And they just went and redid the same finish twice. So that definitely was not the plan. It was a botch, but a funny one. It was a funny botch. Cole from Philadelphia. So I'm watching TNA, and Dixie Carter was cutting her usual shitty promo, and I thought to myself, you always hear people rank top talkers in the history of wrestling, but it's rare that you'll hear people bring up female talkers. And in my eyes, the best female talkers are Trish Stratus, Dawn Marie, Sonny, Mickie James, and AJ Lee. So my question to you is, which female is on your list of top talkers? Sonny and AJ are pretty high up there. AJ is really good, but I probably would put Stephanie McMahon at the top of my list in terms of females. Sherry Martel's another good one. She wasn't the best, but she was good. Stephanie, even back when she first started on TV and her voice was like nails on a frickin' chalkboard, she was a good talker. You could always understand what she was saying. She had the facial expressions to go along with it. She's just like her father. You know, she's great. I don't need to see her on TV all the time, but when she is, her delivery is great. So Stephanie would probably be at the top of my list. Ronald from Iowa. They always say Japanese talent can't get over in America, but do you think it's more to do with the politics of wrestling or even prejudice? Wrestlers like Muda, Tajiri, Kenta, and Morishima have all gained followings in America despite limited exposure. Where Japanese or any minority in the U.S. wrestling market are given a chance, I believe they could be a star. What do you think? I agree, 100%. I have never agreed with this notion. And you see it in WWE. You just see it in the way they book these guys. They've never, I don't know if I should say never. Maybe at some point they did, but I'm coming up blank when I think of them pushing an Asian or a Japanese star really, really hard, like a truly top guy. It's never happened. And no, Yokozuna doesn't count. So it's sure, you look at Ring of Honor, you look at some indie promotions. Great Muda had a good run in WCW, NWA, late 80s, early 90s. He was pushed as, he may be the closest thing, now that I think about it. He was never the guy. He was never even the top heel, but he was way up there. That's more than I can say for WWE. And then you'll have people who say, you know, well, why are they so racist? There's never been a black person holding the WWE title. I don't have a good answer for you. I've always said, if there was somebody who came along who happened to be black or who happened to be Hispanic, but was over, or there was something about them, and Vince McMahon thought, this guy is going to make me millions of dollars, we would have a Hispanic WWE champion. We would have a black WWE champion. Because with these guys, it comes down to business and it comes down to making money. I don't see there being the same politics when it comes to this stuff as maybe you had 15, 20, 30 years ago. Why it doesn't happen more often, I don't know. Ton of talent over in Japan. Ton of guys over there. You can't convince me that if a guy like Tanahashi, or Okada, who's even younger than Tanahashi, or Kota Ibushi, or whoever, I'm not even claiming to be familiar with everybody on the Japanese scene, but I know who some of these guys are. I've seen them wrestle. They're great. They're awesome. Some of them know English better than others. Some of them don't know any English at all. It's one of the reasons why Sin Cara failed in WWE, besides the fact that he was made of glass, and if you blew on him, he fell over. But the guy never learned English. They wanted him to, he just never did. You gotta learn English. I agree with that. If you're gonna be a top star in WWE, or TNA, you've gotta know how to speak the language. Because that's such an important part of your character. Unless you've got a manager, and the art of managers is dead. It kind of started making a comeback a little bit with Paul Heyman, Zeb Coulter, and people like that, but still, it's not what it used to be. There should be more managers. There should be more, and babyface or heel, it doesn't matter. There are guys who just are not good talkers. And when you have a guy who's not a good talker, but you think, okay, this guy could be something. He's big, or he's a great wrestler, he's got a look, whatever, but he can't freaking talk. Put somebody with him. Put somebody with him who can talk. So there's really no good excuse not to give a Japanese guy or a Hispanic guy if you could find that right person. And you're going to tell me that the right person hasn't come along in the last 10, 15, 20 years? Give me a break. There's been a ton of talented guys who came over, didn't go anywhere, or who got passed over. And I agree with you. If booked properly, absolutely they can get over with the audience. The American fans are not stupid. They're preconditioned to think a certain way because this is the way things are done. It might be weird to them. It might take some time. But they're not stupid. And finally here, Al writes in, how come we never got to see a feud between Hulk Hogan and Bret Hart in WWE or WCW? I have seen all of Bret's interviews and how he shoots on Hogan, saying he has little respect for him because Hogan didn't do anything but slam giants and sell out big arenas. I didn't know selling out big arenas was a bad thing. I don't know if he actually said that. That was a stupid thing for him to say. But anyway, he says all the important things like putting people over and educating the young guys in the business is stuff that Hogan just didn't do, according to Bret. Why do you think we never saw Hogan versus Bret Hart rivalry? And why are there more Hulk Hogan haters than there were Chris Benoit haters? The reason is because Hulk didn't want to work with Bret. Plain and simple. If you believe Bret, okay, in this case, and I do, Hogan was supposed to drop the belt to him at SummerSlam in 93. Okay, and they even had some promotional materials put together for the match that never saw the light of day. Somewhere there is a poster, probably in the warehouse in Stamford, of a SummerSlam promotional poster that has Hulk Hogan and Bret Hart on it. It's there somewhere, I believe it. But Hulk did not want to put Bret Hart over because he thought he was too small. So he dropped the belt to Yokozuna, who was this giant fat dude, and he left. And they did work at least one match that I remember together in WCW. I think it was on Nitro. It wasn't even on pay-per-view, which doesn't really mean anything. This is the same company that put Hulk Hogan versus Bill Goldberg on television for free, and then 6 days later had Goldberg on pay-per-view defending the belt against Kurt Hennig. No offense to Mr. Perfect, but that's ass backwards. But I think it was just the one match that they had. I don't think he and Hogan ever had a proper feud in WCW. As far as why there are more Hulk Hogan haters than there were Benoit haters, I'm not sure I get what you mean when you say were. You know, if you mean back in the day when he was tearing it up in the ring every week, year after year, it was because people respected Benoit's work ethic. That's why. Now, if you mean people, you know, why do people more now hate Hogan today than hate Benoit? It's because there's a lot of sick people out there. That's why. You don't have to like Hulk Hogan, but I can't imagine any rational human being liking Chris Benoit today more than Hulk Hogan. You could like the wrestler he used to be, but that's different. To like him as a person, you might want to grab a flashlight and check the floor because you've got a screw loose somewhere. I don't know anybody personally who feels that way, and I'm glad I don't. History has
been made here.
This week in wrestling history, it was 22 years ago this week. Today, in fact, on January 19, 1992, the greatest Royal Rumble of all time was held. Anybody who's listened to this podcast for any length of time knows my thoughts on the 1992 Royal Rumble. On that pay-per-view, actually, Roddy Piper won his first singles title ever in WWE. He beat the Mountie to win the Intercontinental Championship. But it was all about the Royal Rumble match. For the first and to date the only time in history, and I'm shocked they haven't done it since, the WWE title was vacant and it was on the line in the Rumble match, which meant the winner of the Rumble became the new champion. Flair was still relatively new, only a few months into his WWE run at this point. One of the few NWA guys, WCW guys, to come over and not be, you know, saddled with a ridiculous gimmick or anything like that. He was, for the most part, treated very respectfully. And he went in there at number three, which at the time was the earliest that anybody had entered the Rumble and gone on to win. He lasted 60 minutes. They did the finish with Hogan and Sid being dumped out. It was great. I love this Royal Rumble match. It's the best Rumble match of all time. It will never be topped. They had so many different stories going on at the same time. It was, you know, the main story was Flair, who had a beef with a few different people, namely Piper and Hogan, having to deal with them at different points during the match. You had the other side story with Savage and Jake the Snake. Ton of stars in it, too. The most star-studded Rumble match up to that point. They had Flair. Kerry Von Erich was in there. They had a young Shawn Michaels. But they had Hogan, Undertaker, Savage, Jake. The people I'm not even thinking of, I'm sure. All in the Rumble match. And it was great. If you've never seen it, if you're a younger fan, a newer fan, go back and watch that match. That match will get you amped up for the Rumble next weekend. If I had to pick one, that's the one I would pick. And it was 22 years ago this week. It's a long time. 16 years ago this week, on January 18, 1998, Stone Cold Steve Austin won his second consecutive Royal Rumble match. Shawn Michaels beat The Undertaker in a casket match to retain the WWE Championship after Kane interfered and turned on his brother. Then he put Undertaker inside the casket and set it on fire. Thankfully, when the referees opened the casket up a little bit later on, there was no Undertaker inside. So if you like your Undertaker well done, you were very disappointed at the end of the show. This is the match that put Shawn Michaels on the shelf for 4.5 years. He got back body dropped to the outside, and his lower back caught the edge of the casket on the way down, which resulted in two herniated discs, one of which was completely crushed. And he not only finished the match, but he still went on to wrestle Steve Austin and dropped the belt at WrestleMania 14. I'm sure he was hopped up on all sorts of drugs at the time, but still impressive. See, if they would have done the match with Owen Hart and Shawn Michaels at the Royal Rumble instead, like I suggested on a recent Sound Off, this all could have been avoided. 14 years ago this week, on January 17, 2000, Stone Cold Steve Austin underwent spinal fusion surgery that would keep him out of action for over 9 months. Maybe the most famous surgery in the history of wrestling, when you consider how high up on the food chain Austin was. He was the man. He was the top star in the business at that time. And to go down with an injury like that, and with surgery keeping him out that long, it could have been a devastating blow to the company. And it's actually pretty amazing to think how they were able to persevere through it. They had built up enough stars on their roster, the exact opposite of what WCW did, that they were able to sustain losing their biggest star for 9 months. It was the injury that he suffered when Owen Hart dropped him on his head many years earlier, just kind of caught up with him. That's when they did the angle at Survivor Series to write him out when he got run down by Rikishi. But like I said, probably the most significant surgery in the history of the company, certainly. And Rock and Triple H, you know, and their supporting cast, Angle, Jericho, the Radicals, they all carried the load very well in the year 2000. But, you know, business was never the same, and neither was Austin. I know he came back and he had great success for a while, but to me, there are three phases of Austin in WWE. We've heard of the three phases of Foley. Well, there's three phases of Austin. The pre-pile driver phase, where he was a more technical wrestler, he was a good bump taker. Go back and watch Austin back then. He moved around in there pretty good. Then there's the post-pile driver phase, where he couldn't do a lot of those things anymore. He didn't move around quite as well. He had the knee braces showed up and all that. So he had to adapt his style. He became more of a brawler. And then there's the post-surgery phase, where his style didn't change much. He was still a brawler, but he never quite reached that same level of popularity that he had before. A lot of that casual audience was starting to erode, I think partially because Austin went away. When Austin went away for 9 months, a lot of those fans lost interest, and it was a slow decline from there. And of course, they did the heel turn, which was a mistake in hindsight, and that chased away a ton of other fans. I mean, the numbers don't lie. A lot of fans stopped watching after Austin turned heel in 2001. So this was the transition from phase two to phase three of Austin. 13 years ago this week, on January 13, 2001, it was the final ECW event. The original ECW's final event ever was held in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, of all places. When I think of the original ECW, I think of the ECW Arena in Philadelphia. I think of Elks Lodge in Queens. I think of the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City. I don't think of Pine Bluff, Arkansas. That is not the place I thought ECW would die. Rhino pinned Spike Dudley to retain his ECW World Heavyweight title, but in the main event, Just Incredible pinned the Sandman, straight wrestling match, which then led to a hardcore match immediately following between the two of them, with Sandman going over. And the two men hugged in the ring afterwards. The entire locker room emptied out into the ring. Tommy Dreamer got on the mic to thank all the fans for their support. And the show ended with everybody drinking beer in the ring. And 2 months later, on March 5th, Paul Heyman popped up on WWE television as Jim Ross's new sidekick on commentary. And a month after that, on April 4th, ECW officially declared bankruptcy. Only one day later, on January 14, 2001, WCW held its first and last Sin pay-per-view event in Indianapolis, notable for featuring Bill Goldberg's final WCW match and also for one of the worst injuries I have ever witnessed in the main event. Lex Luger and Buff Bagwell, calling themselves totally buffed, beat Goldberg and Dwayne Bruce, who you may remember as Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker, later became the head trainer at the WCW Power Plant and is credited with having trained Bill Goldberg, hence their partnership here. Although, I don't remember the storyline around this whole thing. The stipulation was that if Goldberg lost, he would be banned for life from WCW. You know, as it turned out, it was true. Maybe the only retirement stipulation WCW ever honored, and that was only because they were dead 2 months later. Goldberg did lose after a fan planted in the crowd in the front row maced him. This poor guy. His streak ended after being tasered, and his career ended after being maced. Maybe it's best that he stay retired. It's not worth the risk. He was scheduled to have shoulder surgery, it's easy for me to say, which is why they added that stipulation. But as I mentioned, he was still recovering at home when WCW was sold to WWE. And in the main event, Scott Steiner beat Jeff Jarrett and Sid Vicious to retain the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. There was a fourth mystery opponent who did not appear until the end of the match wearing a mask. That was Road Warrior Animal. This is when Sid jumped off the second rope for a big boot to Steiner, and his leg snapped in half. Very similar to the Anderson Silva injury at the most recent UFC pay-per-view, only this was worse because he snapped his tibia, he snapped his fibia, and unlike Silva, one of the bones actually did break through the skin. We just couldn't see it because he was wearing a boot. But gruesome. Just gruesome stuff. Awful. You know, horrible. There's not enough words to describe this injury. He suffered a compound fracture and had a 17-inch rod placed in his leg during surgery. That figured to be it for him. And it was, on a major scale. He never worked for a major promotion again full-time, but he did come back and wrestle again, which is amazing. You know, you have to remember, Sid's a big dude, and he was already 40-something years old when he broke his leg. He wasn't a young man anymore. That's a hard thing to come back from. What happened, according to Sid, is that management suggested he try the move. Sid was not known for coming off the top rope or the middle rope or whatever. I know he did on occasion during his career, but he was not known for his aerial prowess. And to be honest, he wasn't known for being all that good on the ground either. Not only did they replay the injury on Nitro the next night, they showed it from like three or four different camera angles. He claims he didn't want to do it, but they insisted. And more specifically, John Laurinaitis, the same John Laurinaitis we got to see on Raw every single week.
I'm the Executive Vice President of Talent Relations.
Yeah, that guy. Sid ended up suing WCW, and he sued Laurinaitis for breach of contract and negligence, among other things. This is where it gets a bit complicated, but I'm fascinated by this kind of stuff. When WCW got sold to Vince McMahon, Sid's contract was not one of the contracts they picked up, obviously. There were actually two divisions of WCW, if you want to call it that. One was WCW Incorporated, which is what Vince got. The tape library, the copyrights, pay-per-view names, all that stuff. And then there was something called Universal Wrestling Corporation, which was responsible for a lot of those guaranteed contracts they gave out like candy back in the day, that they still had to pay these guys on those contracts. Well, a few months later, they cut Sid's pay, and then in June, he was fired. So, Sid technically sued the UWC, that Universal Wrestling Corporation. He lost on all but one of his claims. He appealed the decision a few years later, and he lost again. And what he insisted was, Laurinaitis told him to do the move. It was in the script. Laurinaitis said, oh, you know, I got to go rewrite the script if you don't do this move, which is ridiculous. I mean, it was one move. But Sid agreed to do it. He was coerced into doing it, he argued. And he got hurt as a result. I had not realized that when Ted Turner initially purchased Jim Crockett Promotions in the 80s, they renamed it originally Universal Wrestling Corporation, which is where that name comes from. But then they quickly renamed it again to World Championship Wrestling. Yeah, but you hear stories about Sid. He wasn't always the most well-liked guy. He wasn't easy to work with. He was very unreliable, constantly no-showing events. You know, not necessarily when he was in WWF or WCW, but any other promotion or indie that he would work for. And you could tell he might not have been the most, you know, easiest person in the world to work with, given how many times he came and went from those two companies. But you got to feel sorry for the guy in this situation. It was a really shitty thing that happened to him, and then for them to do what they did shows a real lack of class on their part. 8 years ago this week, January 15, 2007, TNA held its second annual Final Resolution pay-per-view, which featured AJ Styles beating Hiroshi Tanahashi, who is a far bigger star in Japan now than AJ Styles is in this country, and the TNA return of Sting. And really, most consider this his debut. He did wrestle a few matches for them in, like, 2003, shortly after the company was born. But this was Sting's debut in the Spike era. And on this show, he teamed with Christian Cage to beat Jeff Jarrett and the Alpha Male, Monty Brown. And finally, it was 4 years ago this week, on January 17, 2010, TNA held its Genesis pay-per-view in Orlando. How timely. The first pay-per-view of the Hulk Hogan-Eric Bischoff regime. They came to the ring to open the show. They were greeted by chants of, "We want six sides," to which Hogan responded, "You had it, and it only got you so far." One of the first things Hogan and Bischoff did when they got to TNA was get rid of the six-sided ring for the traditional square ring, and that pissed off all the diehards in Orlando. Hogan said, "We're not going to have any six sides, eight sides, or playpen rings. This is where men wrestle." And talk, apparently. He said he was proud to be part of a wrestling company, not sports entertainment like their competitor. And then later on, he looked in the camera and said, "What are you going to do, Vince McMahon, now that TNA is coming for you, brother?" If that doesn't sum up the Hogan-Bischoff era of Impact Wrestling in a nutshell, I don't know what does. And that's this week in wrestling history. If you have questions for the mailbag, TheSolomonster@gmail.com. That's where you want to email them to. I'm still playing catch-up on a lot of your emails from even just a few weeks ago. Again, I apologize. I do see everything. I'm going to try to respond to as many as I can in the coming days. So, again, bear with me. Follow me on Twitter. @Solomonster is my handle. I live tweet during Raw every single week. Impact when I'm actually around on Thursdays to watch it. Pay-per-views, all that stuff. So you can follow me on there. Facebook, we're on our Facebook group page, we are now in excess of 900 members, which means we're on our way to the big 1,000. Hopefully you can be one of them. It's a closed group, so just type in the full name of the podcast. You'll see the group come up, apply for membership. I will approve you. We have a Royal Rumble pool going on that one of our listeners started, which is kind of a fun idea. I think the pool may already be full. I don't know. You can find the thread on there and and find out. Basically, you are in, and then you get assigned a specific number, random number, and if your number wins the Rumble, if your guy, let's say you pull number 22 and number 22 wins, you win the whole thing, and you'll get a shout-out on the sound-off. And I already said, if I win, I'll give myself a shout-out on the sound-off, but I don't think I'm winning. So get on there. We also have our Facebook profile page. That's where I'm going to put up that Ultimate Warrior, not the Warrior letter. I don't have a copy of that, but the Vince McMahon letter to the Ultimate Warrior from 91 that I referenced earlier. I'll put that picture up on my Facebook page, and you can find my photo with the Warrior from that infamous lecture at Hofstra 10 years ago. Can't believe it's been that long, but all that good stuff is on Facebook. Subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. You never know when a new Sound Off Extra episode may go up there. So, the Solemn Monster, all one word, is my username. That's how you can find the appropriate channel and subscribe. And you can listen to this show every week on Stitcher Radio. You can listen to the show through iTunes. We have a free Android app in the Google Play Store. If one method doesn't work for you, I guarantee there's two or three others that will. There is no excuse for you not to listen and subscribe to this show each and every week. And those of you listening, I thank you for tuning in and spreading the good word of the Sound Off. You can make a PayPal donation on thesolemnmonster.com and give some love to audible.com for sponsoring the show. They've got a good service. Like I said earlier, they've got a pretty good selection of wrestling titles. And even if you're not into wrestling books, but you're an avid reader or you just want something to listen to when you're on your commute to work or at the gym, they will send you a free audiobook when you sign up for your free trial. You're not going to be billed. You're not going to be committed to anything unless you want to be. You can pull out anytime you want to and keep your audiobook. But if you go to audibletrial.com/Solemnmonster and you do sign up, you get your free book. And it's a great way to support this podcast, too. So go ahead and check that out and let me know what you think. If you do get a book, I'm curious to get your feedback on it. So we're going to wrap things up here with episode 310. Thank you again for tuning in. Next weekend is the Royal Rumble, which means that next weekend Sound Off will have Royal Rumble predictions. Should be fun. Until then, be well, stay safe, enjoy your week, and we will see you right back here next weekend for number 311. Until then, take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Solemn Monster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Because I'm the man!
You don't shut your mouth, I am going to punch you in the face.
The bad.
You're going to prove to the world that all you are is a B-plus player.
And the ugly.
And then Hogan announces that he's going to defend the championship, Bully Ray is, against the same Sting who just 3 months ago lost a match where if he lost, he can never again get another title shot. What in the fuck just happened?
Well, mostly the good.
I can't get a break with Ace's names. I got to get rid of this bastard. I got to get rid of this club. This club sucks.
The Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesolemnmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes, The Solemn Monster Sounds Off.